This week on Behind the Lens. Troubles continue for John F. Kennedy High School after a special education student was sent to finish out the school year at home. Marta Jusen will explain. Also, infrastructure repairs. The Sewerage and Water Board needs money to overhaul the city's sewer system, a major project that's been ongoing for decades. Michael Isaac Stein has that story. And a record number of women are running for seats in the Louisiana legislature, but the state still ranks in the bottom five when it comes to women holding elected office. I'll talk with Tulane political science professor Maria Holman. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
In 2018, a John F. Kennedy High School student receiving special education services was sent home after Thanksgiving break, told to finish out the remainder of his senior year at home using a school laptop. But it turns out the courses he took online are the same courses at the Center of Graduation Problems at the school. Lens education reporter Marta Jusen joins me now. Marta, you've spoken to TJ and his mother, Nicole Jones. Did they agree with the school sending TJ home for more than half of the school year to finish his coursework?
Ms. Jones says that she absolutely did not agree with that and was not happy with that placement at all. In special education situations, schools are supposed to try and educate a student in the least restrictive way possible. And we've talked to a special education lawyer who says homebound service is basically one of the most restrictive ways to educate a student would be by sending them home and being isolated in their home.
And can you tell me a little bit about why TJ was receiving special education services?
TJ is diagnosed with both bipolar disorder and ADHD. He's had an IEP since he was a little kid. An IEP, an individualized education plan, is a document. It's actually a contract that a school and a parent sign together. And in that document, it's kind of like an educational roadmap. It lays out, you know, how the student needs to be helped and in what ways, what kind of services they need. And then if they need any special accommodations, like maybe extra time on tests or to have a test read aloud to them. So if TJ was sent home, that should have been written in his IEP and his mom would have agreed to it. She says she never did that.
And what about the school? Did the school provide any detail about whether or not this homeschooling situation was written into his IEP?
We brought these allegations to the school and board president Raphael Gang got back to us recently. He said that they're investigating and addressing everything and that they have found that his homebound status did not appear to be in line with what was written in his IEP.
And, you know, to that end, the Orleans Parish School District has been under a federal consent decree since 2015 for failure to provide adequate special education services. Have they said anything about that in regards to this specific situation with TJ?
The district hasn't said anything specifically about TJ. They said that they know that New Beginnings told them about the allegations after we brought them to the charter group and that the district says that the charter network is investigating. So that's all the district has said at this point.
Does this sort of thing potentially cause any conflict or problems with them regarding the consent decree?
I think it potentially could. We talked to Victor Jones, who's a lawyer for the Southern Poverty Law Center, told him about the allegations and the homebound situation. And he said that he thought that that seemed extremely restrictive and that if that was not written into his IEP, along with a number of steps that need to happen, including a recommendation and meeting with his mother and his mother agreeing, that would be a blatant violation of the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, which is the federal law that governs special education and charter schools here.
And because all of this is being investigated, the school hasn't said anything about why they sent TJ home, have they?
They have not elaborated. Raphael Gang, the board president, has basically said, you know, some of these allegations are years old and a lot of these employees have turned over. So he said it's been very hard to kind of figure out what happened because they're just trying to backtrack so much and some of the employees aren't there anymore.
And compounding this situation for TJ is that the coursework he did at home online was the same program that the state says JFK High School misused, which, as you've been reporting, has resulted in students not being eligible to graduate. So how is this affecting TJ?
So he had actually already repeated his senior year, stayed for an extra year because he didn't quite have the credits to graduate. Going into the spring, he thought he would be good to go, be able to graduate. With everything that's happened, the school told him that he would need to repeat 4 different courses. His mom was like, wait, are you kidding? Like, I know he passed these 2 courses. And she went back to the school, told them that. They came back and were like, oh, yeah, you're right. He doesn't have to take those 2. So I know Miss Jones was incredibly frustrated, by the way, that that happened, that she had to, you know, why didn't the school know that he had completed those 2 courses? Why did she have to go and figure that out for him? I know she's very frustrated by that. So he does still need to complete 1 course. And another actually interesting issue about this situation is that because TJ was there for an extra year, he took a geometry course 2 years ago, not this last year. And he has noted that if they weren't going to count that geometry course for him, that probably means they shouldn't have counted that geometry course for kids who graduated in the class of 2018. I mean, that opens up a whole another set of questions about what kids who graduated from Kennedy previously either had or qualified for, whether or not they were making the grade.
On top of all of this, the family also alleges that TJ was mistreated in his classroom.
Correct. The family says that there was a period of time where TJ was basically solely educated in a room that didn't open from the inside. They say that he was in there with the teacher, that the 2 of them didn't have a key to get out. Now, New Beginnings is disputing that. They say the employee is disputing that what the family is describing. They also say they're still investigating. We don't actually really know what went on there, but we do know what the family is saying. We hear what New Beginnings is saying, and we'll follow that going forward to see how it resolves.
And this all ties into another recent report that you did regarding the access that parents and students have to special education services with New Orleans charter schools.
Right. So actually what we reported on last week was that gifted services don't actually fall within federal special education law. They do fall within state special education law, but charters are exempt from state special education law. So the only law governing charter schools is that federal IDEA law, which is what's protecting TJ in this case and what protects all other special education students. So charters do have to follow that federal special education law, and that's what the consent decree centers around. I spoke with the lawyer who leads that case, and he said, with what we've described, like, that's literally the reason the consent decree needs to be around. So I think, if anything, he's thinking that it might need to be around for a little bit longer.
Marta Jusen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board needs money to overhaul the city's sewer system as a requirement of a decades-long federal consent decree. The City Council's Public Works Committee passed a resolution this week to allow the Sewerage and Water Board to issue bonds to collect the funding. Michael Isaac Stein joins me with more on this story. Michael, what's the specific problem that the Sewerage and Water Board needs to address here?
Yeah, the problem can actually be dated all the way back to 1998 when the Sewerage and Water Board signed a consent decree with the federal government. It was with the Justice Department on behalf of the EPA. And what the EPA had alleged was that the city was releasing untreated sewage into the Mississippi River, Lake Pontchartrain, and other waterways. My reading of it is that a lot of it was by accident. A lot of what they're talking about was basically cracked pipes that was leaking into groundwater and things like that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, so they had to kind of create this remediation plan that was approved by the EPA. And that plan is broken down into 9 different basins. So basically, as the Sewerage and Water Board explains it, you can kind of break down the city, the geographic area, into kind of these 9 different bowls where water collects. And so far, we've remediated 5 of those. A 6th is fully funded and expected to be done later this year. So this funding would be for the 7th. Drainage basin and basically fixing up the sewer systems there. So it's called the South Shore Basin, and it's the part of New Orleans East that is above the interstate towards the lake. So this would go towards that. This is, I should note, not connected to the drainage problems, but is a sewage-specific problem that's required by the consent decree.
Yeah, a completely different problem that the New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board needs to contend with. And this is 1998, this is a decades-long situation. Why has it taken so long to fix this, and what are the requirements of the consent decree in that case?
Yeah, I think Hurricane Katrina played a big role in this, at least. The consent decree has been amended three times, once in 2010, then 2013 and 2014. And in the most recent iteration, they do talk about kind of the havoc wreaked by the hurricane at the time. And also, these are obviously pretty expensive fixes. This is $25 million here. And the two remaining basins that are still unfunded, combined, according to the Sewerage and Water Board, will cost another $100 million. So it's an expensive problem.
So what's the plan for obtaining this this $25 million in funding?
It's basically a loan from the it's called the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. It's run by the Department of Environmental Quality, and it basically is just a big sum of money that gives out low interest loans for upgrades or fixes in public utilities that deal with water. The loan deal is pretty good. It's a 0.95% fixed interest rate over 22 years, far better than what you get on the market. So it's kind of cheap funding up front. I should also mention for the last two basins that haven't been fixed yet, they're looking to a different low interest fund from the federal government. They're in the process of applying right now. And for those basins, that's actually that's the current plan. So as was stated during the meeting, if we don't get that loan, it's going to be a difficult conversation to see how we come up with this $100 million or so for the remaining two basins.
The money that the Sewerage and Water Board is ready to borrow from the Clean Water State Revolving Fund is for this South Shore Basin. What are the other two that need to be fixed? And ultimately, what is the deadline on this consent decree agreement?
Yeah, so the last two are the Carrollton and Mid-City basins. And according to the consent decree, those both have to be finished by 2025.
So by that point, it will be 27 years from the start of this consent decree to the finish, and hundreds of millions of dollars. Do we know how much this whole project is costing the Sewerage and Water Board?
I talked to the Sewerage and Water Board, and although they had an estimate for those last two remaining basins, they didn't have an estimate for how much this entire project has cost. Part of the reason for that might be that, you know, again, this started in 1998. There's been a lot of executive directors. I mean, I guess records were on paper back then. So there's a lot of factors that might make it difficult to tally the entire thing. But, you know, based off those last two basins, which combined will cost $100 million, you can assume that this has cost a lot to the Sewerage and Water Board in the city.
And it's not like it's going to be paid off anytime soon, because this loan is a two decades long loan, which really only goes to drive home how costly major infrastructure repairs are.
Yeah, I again and again, the Sewerage and Water Board says this, right? I mean, sometimes when you look at, you know, we focus on drainage most, and looking at that, the immensity of the task of digging up streets and coordinating with public works. I mean, it is a really fixing our water systems, sewage and drainage. They're just really massive undertakings.
Michael Isaacstein, thank you for that report.
Thank you.
When the candidate qualifying period closed for Louisiana's 2019 elections, a record 77 women had signed up to run for a seat in the legislature. But even if all of those women win their campaigns, Louisiana will still rank near the bottom when it comes to females in elected office. I sat down with Maria Holman, an associate professor of political science at Tulane University, to talk about the hurdles women face when seeking elected office in Louisiana and the organizations trying to help. Maria, why do you think we're seeing this increase in women running for statewide office?
That's a great question. So one of the reasons that we can track directly is because we have seen the emergence of a couple of candidate training organizations in Louisiana specifically targeted at recruiting women to run for office, training them to run for office, and then providing support when they run for office. So Emerge is one of the sort of national examples of one of these types of organizations. Louisiana, as they are in many ways related to women in politics, was sort of behind the times when it came to these organizations, and we've only recently had really active candidate training organizations. 23 of the women that are running are Emerge alums. So they have been directly trained by these organizations. Certainly we can attribute some of it to that. But there's also some suggestion that this is part of a more national trend, that we have more women interested in running for office. Maybe that's due to Donald Trump and a reaction to Donald Trump. Maybe that's due to seeing a lot of success in 2018 in many state legislatures and in Congress and having a lot of high-profile women run and win. Maybe it's due to just changing times. Whatever it is, it's a positive sign for Louisiana, which is reliably in the bottom 10% of states in terms of women's representation in the United States.
So there's obviously a lot to pinpoint here. Of the 77 women who are running, 43, so more than half of them, are Democrats. You mentioned Emerge America, which specifically works with Democratic candidates. Generally, are groups recruiting more Democrats or more Democratic women?
That's a great question also. So theoretically, no. There are candidate training groups that are nonpartisan. There are candidate training groups that are explicitly partisan for Republicans and Democrats. There are a lot of candidate groups that are not explicitly partisan, but have a particular set of issues that they look for their candidates to endorse that make them then training groups for Democratic women. So one of the principal ones is related to pro-choice. So a lot of organizations require that the candidates that they train and recruit be pro-choice. In Louisiana, that means that they are recruiting Democratic women. There are not very many Republican women in this state that are willing to say that they are pro-choice, for example. So if you just look sort of bird's eye view at women's candidate training organizations across the United States, it's not clear, oh, there's a ton more for Democrats than there are for Republicans. But when you drill down and actually look at what these candidate training groups do, there's far more that are recruiting women on the Democratic side. This also, though, relates to differences in the party cultures. So the Democratic Party generally in the United States is far more receptive to concerns around identity and discussions around the importance of identity. They're also a party that is structured in a way that makes them very receptive to group-based interests. The Republican Party is a far more hierarchical organization. Party members themselves are very reluctant to engage in identity discussions, and it is not an organization that has a lot of history of welcoming group-based efforts. When group-based efforts have happened, say the Tea Party in 2010, that has been sort of besides the Republican Party's best interest. Like, they don't want the Tea Party to come up as this group. And so sort of the underlying structures of the parties mean that the Democratic Party is far more receptive to groups that are interested in supporting women than the Republican Party is.
Another thing that you mentioned is that female representation in the state legislature is one of those lists where Louisiana falls at the bottom. There's data from Pew Charitable Trusts that supports that. Other southern states are also among that bottom group. Why is that? Is that because these states tend to be Republican, and what you were just talking about more women running as Democrats?
So, yes, we're often fighting with Alabama and Mississippi for sort of the bottom of lists in terms of women's representation. There's a couple of reasons. One is certainly about the party composition of the state legislature in southern states. Women over the last 15 years or so have reliably become more likely to be elected out of the Democratic Party. That doesn't tell the whole story, though. Some of it also has to do with state culture around ideas about women more generally, whether or not women belong in politics. Louisiana is a conservative state, and people have very strong beliefs about whether or not women really should be a part of something like politics. Louisiana also struggles with other indicators that would limit women's ability to run for office. So Louisiana is often one of the states with the highest wage gap between men and women. Louisiana has low levels of women getting college degrees. Louisiana has low levels of women in managerial positions. If we think about the traditional portfolio of somebody that runs for political office, these are people that have money, that have college educations, that have a position of economic power, and Louisiana is not a place where women reliably have access to those things.
It's really interesting that you mentioned those factors because a lot of those issues came up in this past legislative session. Retiring Senator J.P. Morrell, who's been a champion of women's rights during his time in the legislature, retiring because he's termed out. In a floor speech at the end of the session, he railed against the 2019 session, saying the legislature failed women by failing to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, a minimum wage increase, equal pay, in addition to passing all of these restrictive abortion bills. So do you agree with his take on the last legislative session?
Yes, I would agree with JP's take on this. In particular, there's a couple of things that happen in the session that are sort of even beyond what's happening in other places. So we've seen a lot of activity across state legislatures around abortion bans in the last year. So Louisiana is not particularly unique in that. But the failure of, for example, JP's effort to pass a tax exemption for tampons is a really good example of this, right? So this would simply say that tampons shouldn't have a sales tax on them. This is referred to sort of often as the pink tax. This is a tax that only women pay, and they have to pay it. Women have to buy menstrual supplies. And this is sort of an example of something that was really, when it came down to the state budget, a very small thing, and yet it was something that the legislature was just unwilling to do, even though it was a small thing. So, you know, something like that, certainly as a woman, as a resident of Louisiana, I look at that and I think, they don't care. They don't genuinely care about what women's lives are like. It was also several of these were very close votes. And one might think that if we had moved from, we're currently at 16% women, to if all of these 77 women are elected, we'll be at 23% women. But that would mean a large increase in just the number of women in both bodies. In that context, we might have seen a different outcome on some of these votes.
And that's interesting, too, because, you know, people who followed the legislature saw that there were plenty of female legislators who voted against the Equal Rights Amendment. So just because you're a woman doesn't mean you necessarily vote, I guess, the way people would traditionally expect you to in support of women.
Yeah, absolutely. And we want to be very careful about not what we'd say essentializing women, that just because you are a woman, then you're going to be sort of this robot and only have a particular set of opinions and attitudes. So expecting, for example, a Republican woman to go against party and a variety of additional pressures to vote against this abortion bill, I would not expect that. But for something where we might expect this to be sort of a non-politicized issue, like the tampon tax, this is not something where one party owns or doesn't own tampon taxes, that might be a circumstance where we think that women's representation would actually matter. And if we look at the voting patterns, that is what happened with that, is that women voted for that overwhelmingly.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation that there could be some sort of push from the national elections of 2018, this kind of wave or groundswell that, you know, might push through 2019. How do you see this playing out with these women candidates in our legislature? What kind of impact might they make, and where else do we stand in terms of women's representation?
Well, hopefully we will see an increase in the number of women elected. So of the candidates that have filed, there are a couple that I think probably are long shot candidates, but there are a good set of them that have real chance at winning, or at least a strong chance at making it through sort of the first round of elections. That being said, if they, as I said before, if they all win, we're at 23%, which is still below the national average of 28%, and less than half of Nevada, which has the highest number of women, they're over 50%, right? So even if we do really, really well this cycle, we're still quite far behind a lot of other places. If you add on to that, that we have no women in Congress, we have no women at the high levels of the state executive, we have no women in leadership in the state legislature, we're still way, way underwater when it comes to these things. One can also hope that 2019 is the beginning or a continuation of sort of a better cycle. We also saw the last election was the highest number of women filing ever. That didn't actually translate into really high levels of women elected, but we saw really high levels of women filing. We've seen some women filing for state executive office over the last couple of years. So one will hope that this means then that as these infrastructures grow, we see more and more women running for office in Louisiana. That being said, the candidate training infrastructures that are here are Democratic candidate training organizations, and we are a state dominated by the Republican Party. If we want more women in politics, we have to identify, train, and support Republican women to run for office. We cannot just train one side of the political equation.
Mary Holman, Associate Professor of Political Science here at Tulane, thank you so much for your time.
Happy to be here.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, please consider supporting independent journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org and make a donation today.